All right, this is Jeff Machota. We're doing one of the Nature's Table oral histories. It is Thursday, July 7th, 2016, and I'm here with Lori Solomon. So, Lori, I'm going to start off with asking you what brought you to Champaign-Urbana and when?
Well, I came here two times. First time I came here for graduate school in about, 64-5 period. Left here to do dissertation research back in Delaware in about 68. And was there for a while. Then I went and taught in Macomb. And that didn't work out, and so it was a choice of either going back to Delaware or coming back to Champaign. It was cheaper to come back to Champaign. The irony is, at the time, I still had friends in Champaign, some people that I went to school with, etc. By the time I got back here, they had all left, and so I was here, and I've been here ever since.
What year did you come back then?
That's sometime in... maybe the mid-70s.
Mid-70s, okay.
And ironically, I guess, even the whole time that I left, I was still here. And to explain that is I would come back and visit people, and I was come back like for a week, and I'd stay three. So the next year I'd say, well, I'm going back for 3 weeks, and I wind up staying for 3 months. And it kept getting longer and longer. So I was here during that whole period of the 70s, some of the demonstrations and stuff in the late 60s and that sort of thing. And so that was the period in between the two times that I was here. When I came back here the second time, of course, I didn't have a job or anything else, and I crashed with Lou Gold in his apartment, and basically started working with him. He was doing some carpentry and that sort of stuff, and over the course of time, I started working with people like Mike Schuller and Larry Buckley on remodeling houses and stuff along that line. And then eventually I worked at Bergner's for a while.
And where was that one at? Was it at Lincoln Square or was that at?
Bergner's, no, this was before Lincoln Square even became, this was the one out at Marketplace Mall.
Okay.
And That was about close to 1990, because my mother died in 1990, and I went down to Florida, and I wound up staying because of her passing and having to deal with the affairs there. I wound up staying like four to six weeks instead of a week or two that I had a vacation time. When I got back, people at Bergner's were upset because I stayed that long, but they couldn't fire me, so they made life a little bit more miserable. And I said, okay, I've had it. And I, one time, instead of going to work, I went to a party at Doc Scott's house.
You said 1990. That can't be right. Do you just jump ahead to 1990?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm filling in the period.
Got it. So how did you first go to the table or meet Terry, or what brought that about?
Well, it was earlier. It was when I, about a year or two after I got here, which was a year after the table opened.
1 second.
It was a year after the table opened, and Lou and I decided they were just starting to have music.
And so the table opened in mid-1979? or the fall of 79, and music started in spring of 80. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, something like that. It's, I know it opened in 79. I'm not sure when in 79. We went there. It was not the very first gig that they had, but it was a couple gigs after that when we heard that they were having music.
And so
we,
you and Lou Gold went, you said?
Went over there. And I forget now who we heard, but...
So this would have been the spring of 1980 or so, probably?
Something like that, yeah. And so basically... We started going over there, and I started hanging over there a lot. It was the period that Bill Westcott was in town.
He was a piano player, correct?
You're right. He was a ragtime piano player who played at breakneck speed, and he was legally blind, and he'd be playing at breakneck speed, finish his piece, and he'd look up and he'd have this angelic smile, like, didn't I do great, you know, on there. But and Ron Dewar was around then, and the two of them sometimes would gig together. Then a little later on, Lynn Holiday started coming around and playing. But I hung there for a while, and of course, Lou at the time, I remember, sometimes would record stuff on a reel-to-reel. And one of the gigs he recorded was a gig with Lynn Holiday and Ron Dewar. And I'm not sure whether it was Joan Hickey on piano and Friedman on drums, but it may have been someone else on drums, I'm not sure. Which was one of the best gigs I ever went to because they played blues up and down and they actually were talking to each other on their saxophones. And it was, rather than serial soloing, they were actually interacting with each other during the tune. And I haven't seen that done since, really. But prior to that, there were a few gigs. There weren't that many big names coming down that would come into the table. They're all basically local people who were playing for that in the next couple of years. About jumping ahead to about 88, 89, I started working at the table as a night manager, and Terry would get a break.
88 or 89, that can't be right. It closed in 91.
You're right.
I was working there at that
You're
point.
Right. It wasn't.
So it had to be like 82 or something, or 83?
Maybe. It was. I was working there also during the period I was working at Bergner's, and I worked there after I left Bergner's. And I'm trying to get the time frame correct, because I know my mother passed away in 1990, and I quit Bergner's right around that time.
What were you doing at Bergner's?
I was a clerk in fabrics and toys.
Okay.
Real trip. learned a lot about fabrics, but...
I'm going to do a sidebar for a second. Let's explain who Lou Gold is.
Okay. Lou Gold was a political science faculty member at the time. He was highly active as an activist. And he had left the university primarily because he didn't finish his dissertation, and they wanted to get rid of him because they considered him a troublemaker to begin with. And he started doing carpentry and cabinet making. And he left, and don't remember the time period. He left somewhere in the 90s, in the early 90s, for Oregon, and went and sat on a mountain in Oregon protecting the forests. And now he's in Brazil. But he was quite active in a lot of the demonstrations and student stuff while he was at the university, and I guess a little bit after that. Much of that occurred in the period after I had officially left town and was back east. But earlier, like when I was in graduate school, of course, the political science department sort of led the revolution of the 60s with the sit-ins and everything else. And he and several people, Phil Maranto and Michael Parenti, were all active as part of that group. And Lou, after he left the university, I think still engaged in some activism and demonstrations at Rantoul or something along that line, anti-war types of demonstrations. That's pretty much...
Okay. So you said when you first went to the table with him, were you going to see other music in Champaign-Urbana around that time, before the table started or right when the table started?
Yes and no. We went to a lot of free stuff when we went together. And during that period, there were a couple groups where Beckman is now was an open field. And they used to have some, in the summer, some outdoor concert blues groups and stuff along that line.
That was right by where Strawberry Fields was.
Right, yeah. And Metamorphosis and that whole alternate culture.
Earthworks Garage was there too? Was
that open? No, it was further, it was on First Street.
Okay.
There was Strawberry Fields, which wasn't Strawberry Fields at the time. I think it was called some Earthworks. And then there was Metamorphosis, which was the restaurant that was attached to that. And they were down near that field. But in terms of venues, to be quite honest, there were very few things that you would call jazz venues at the time. There were some venues like Panama Reds, etc., that had jazz players come in and play there every now and then. But a lot of blues and a lot of rock.
How about was Zorba's doing jazz at that point?
Right before? Zorba's didn't exist at that point.
By 1980?
I don't think so.
I think it was opened in the 70s.
I don't remember if it did.
Because they had the mural of Ron Duar there. And by the time I was working at the table by the mid-80s, they were no longer doing jazz.
Right. But when they first opened up, they were doing jazz. I had stopped working at the table, although I was going there frequently. And that was just before... Ron left town, essentially.
Okay.
Bubby and Zadie's was also a big hangout, which was on that same block and down in the basement.
But they didn't do music.
No, they didn't do any music. But Panama Reds, Ruby Gulch were the big music venues at the...
And was that more for touring bands? Because, didn't Mingus play?
Yeah. But, I mean, they didn't have steady jazz. They weren't like the table that had jazz just about every night. It was later on, and I'm not sure, I could be way off on this, but I'm not sure, but I think Herb Ellis may have been the first big name that Terry brought in. And at the time I was working as a night manager type thing, then... The university was bringing people in. Prior to that, there was 1 year that John Garvey had a jazz festival, 1 or 2 years, and several big names came in for that. And sometimes they would come over to the table, sometimes they'd sit in and play, sometimes they just came to listen. Then when budget restraints caused them to eliminate that festival. I'm not sure how Terry did it, but somehow he got a hold of the people that were doing workshops there, or people in the workshops would tell the big names that were there about the table, and they would come over, and sometimes they'd play, and sometimes they would just sit it around. You know, the interesting thing is Marlene Rosenberg, for example, I think met Rufus Reed there and went to study under Rufus Reed in New York for a while.
Interesting.
And I'm not sure whether Rufus, it was in a workshop, or whether she met him over at the table.
So Zorba's opened in 1973.
Okay, well, I don't remember music during that early period going to Zorba's for it.
So, and the Ground Round was doing music.
It was doing mostly Jack Webb Band.
Jack Webb Band.
Which was hot music.
Because the story Terry told me was that he went over to see the Jack Webb Band and wanted to book them. And that's what made him decide to do music. That's what one of the stories he told me.
Okay.
He wanted to know which one was Jack. He didn't realize that it was.
Okay, right. Well, Guy Sinise and Ron Dewar were in that, along with
Mike Miller
and
Scott Mordecai.
And the bass player kept changing from Marlene to Karen Korsmeyer.
And Peter Rumbold played piano with them, at least when they were at the table.
He wasn't a regular.
Okay.
I mean, there were a lot of the places where they didn't have a piano. Mm-hmm. One of them being the Ground Round. And they were at that time. And I guess you may be right, because at that time they were also playing at Zorba's.
Okay.
I'm just thinking earlier that I don't remember.
Well, I'm just trying to get a sense of what else jazz-wise was happening in Champaign-Urbana when Terry started doing jazz. So,
well,
it sounds like there was no regular place doing it, but places that had it.
There were places that had it, and a lot of times there was not places at the time that did a variety. In other words, Jack Webb Band basically was the only one playing at the Ground Round.
Got it.
You know, at Zorba's, I think it was much later that they started having, I think when you started booking stuff, they started having variety.
Yeah, actually, Val started booking it right after the table went down.
Okay, well.
Because they hadn't, during at least from 85 or 84 to 91, they didn't do music.
Okay, there was a period where basically I only remember going there to hear Jack Webb. Now, I'm not sure.
That may have been all they did. Who knows?
No, yeah. I mean, so I don't know whether there was anything else playing there, because I would hang out with those guys. And
because there was that mural and they had the picture of Ron.
Right, and yeah, which they wiped out half of that mural when they redecorated, and then the fire wiped out the rest of it.
No, but I think it's still up. I think the part with him is still up.
Okay.
I haven't been in there in a while.
But
well, so this is all, I'm trying to get, so Terry decides to do jazz. He's already got a restaurant open. Did you go to the restaurant at all early on?
No, I only went there after the music.
So you only went there at night, and then.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would go there sometimes during the day, yeah. But, I mean, I didn't frequent it as a regular until after he started having music.
Okay.
And so I didn't go there when it was basically a natural foods restaurant, you know, and not exclusively.
Do you remember first meeting Terry?
No, I don't.
Do you remember an early Terry story?
An early Terry story.
Maybe the first time you talked to him, or after hanging out, or.
Well,
was he working most of those nights back then, or was who was working?
He was working most of those nights, but he was like in and out.
So somebody else was behind the bar.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't functioning as a manager. And like, he was coming in every night to close, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. But he would go home to spend some time with the kids, or that was even pre-kids.
It would be pre-kids.
And so, you know, I mean, the thing is that he was basically there most nights. Mm-hmm. This was all prior to them breaking through the wall.
So let's create a visual story. So for people who only know the table, later on in the space when you walked in the door, so the door, if you came from across Cranard, so the front door was on the west side of Goodwin, but it was facing east. You walked in, and when I was working there, when I went there, you would go to the left, and that would be a seated area. Then you'd go up to the counter, and then you'd go to the right. You'd go to the part that would be the northernmost part where we saw the bands. But in the early days...
In the early days...
There was a big plate glass window there as well when I was there.
Yeah. There may have been that window there. I don't recall whether the window was there, and there was some sort of a block, a curtain, or a... plywood type blockage across the window on the inside.
Okay.
And that's where the bands would play. They would set up there, and you had to go in and through by the bands in order to go up to the counter because there was no entrance to the other side.
Okay.
Except for a little aisleway close to the wall that separated the counter from that little room that you were talking about on the far west end of that little room. Terry decided he wanted to open it up more for music because, I mean, there was a solid wall there.
So were you ever in the space before it was the table?
No.
And before, right before it was a pizza place?
No, I don't eat pizza, so I was, when I was in graduate school, that block, and I'm not sure whether the buildings were torn down, there was a Spud Nuts thing, which is donuts, and there was a small little supermarket type thing, and I'm not sure whether it was that building or it was one of the ones that they tore down.
I heard that one of either the table or the space that I considered the vacant space between Horizon was a Spud Nuts.
Okay.
So I think that was the Spud Nuts, and maybe there was a little grocery store.
Yeah, there was a little grocery store there as well. Because
I think it was a pizza place before the table because the oven was left over.
Okay.
Because there was a pizza oven.
Well, that also would have been the period that I wasn't in town.
So anyway, it's basically divided into two rooms.
Right.
And if you're in the room where the music was, what the other room, you couldn't see anything.
You couldn't see anything, and you couldn't hear anything because there's a cinder block wall there. I mean, you could hear it, but you couldn't hear it.
So basically, there was a wall all the way up to where the only way to get to the other side was up by the counter?
Right.
Interesting. Okay.
And Terry, at one point, decided he was going to break down that wall between the two rooms. Got a sledgehammer and started trying to knock out the cinder block. Well, that was a real task.
So you were helping out with this?
A little bit. I mean, I didn't have the money to lift and swing that sledgehammer, to be honest, and make a dent in the cinder block. But even for Terry, it got to be too much, so he only knocked down the upper half of the wall, right? And there was a lower half that was there, so it was like a see-through window into the other room.
So that's how it stayed then, right?
Right. And there was, of course, up near the ramp that went in, the old entrance into that room, there was a load-bearing pillar. So we couldn't knock that down. So in effect, you have just an open framed window, basically, from one room to the other.
So after he did that, the music started being on the other side?
Then he moved the music to the other side and set up that wood thing so you had doors that basically went on either side, but he would close off the door that led, if the band was there, mm-hmm. there was a piece of plywood that they would run in front of that door entranceway. Mm-hmm. But that could be opened up if there was no music so that you could enter either way.
Mm-hmm.
In the old version when Ron and Westcott were playing, it was all in the front of the room that the plate glass window was at, and the piano was over on the south wall.
Okay. I have at least one picture from that era, I think, of Lynn and Ron playing.
Lynn, Ron, and I think that's one that Joan,
I think Joan is in,
was
there.
In, too.
Yeah.
And Then there was, after they had Serenity, there was a back room storage room that Shelly would bring Serenity over, and we put her in a cardboard box as a little baby infant and put her in the storage room while Shelly was out front collecting cover and dancing, and Terry was working the counter. And
so when do you remember meeting Shelly for the first time?
Both of them I met pretty much at the same time, and it was when Lou and I were going there for music just to listen. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we just knew them as the proprietors. Mm-hmm. You know, as time went on, obviously I became very friendly with the whole family and would spend a lot of time over at their house. And
when did you start taking pictures there?
Basically, I started taking pictures very early on. I think the first one that I actually took was of Herb Ellis.
That was, I think, 83, I think.
That's yeah. What it was.
So I have a bunch of photos that were in the collection that Shelly gave from 83, it looked like.
Right. But, I mean, Herb Ellis was the first one that I actually set out to do pictures. And it was funny because after I wanted to set up lights and do a real professional job, right? And I asked Herb Ellis where he was going to be standing, etc., so I could set the lights. And he told me, oh, right here. So I set up all these lights after the first two, and he moved. And all his lights were completely unused.
Did he play solo or did he play with the band?
Played solo.
Solo.
And
was that a full house?
If I remember correctly, it was full, but it wasn't standing room or where people were out the door.
And he played at Cranert that night, or he just
played? No, he just played at the table.
Played the
that
table.
Was,
okay.
And
I found a copy of the contract.
Yeah, you told me. And he was actually, I believe, the first well-known professional musician, other than the people that were at the university.
So I think around maybe after that, and within a year or two, there was Rufus Reed, there was Dave Liebman, John McNeil. Those were names that I saw in the mix.
I mean,
so that's all a few years into the table being around then.
Yeah, that was into that few years after basically got established. And that's by that time its reputation had already started to spread between both named people coming to the university to do workshops that the university paid for, being introduced to the table and coming over at night after the workshop, neither playing or listening, and then them going telling other people.
And when you were going in the early days, was there much of a crowd?
Depended on the day. The real early days, no, because really there wasn't that much publicity.
Okay.
And also, it was a period that most of the clientele at night were basically the music students from the university.
Mm-hmm.
And during the day, evidently they did a fairly decent lunch even early on, but for the first couple of years, even after the music started there, it was slow going. You wouldn't get the same sort of crowds that, for example, you might get for Sorghum later on, where you had people hanging outside that sort of thing. After a while, it would build up to where it already had a reputation as being the jazz club in Champaign. And also several of the people that were down here had left and gone back to Chicago, several of the musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And their connections, they would tell people and a lot of people would come down after they had left. So, you know, it was almost like, what I want to say, a word of mouth reputation that developed. And after it had gotten big enough, then it sort of inertia, it started running on its own.
So you mentioned highlights from the early years, Ron and Lynn Halliday playing. You mentioned Bill Westcott. What were some other things that stood out to you, memorable gigs or memorable moments?
Well, I remember gigs, but I don't remember the dates. That's going to be the problem.
That's fine.
I remember Brad and Doug Tiedebeck, and I forget who else, Ancient Babies.
Okay, I've heard of them.
Which basically was, they were doing some really way out jazz. They weren't doing a lot of, you know, standards. And I remember telling them that they needed to put some standards in their repertoire because they had to bring the audience along. It was a steep learning curve, and that if they played constantly stuff that people couldn't relate to, they were going to lose their audience. You know, it's one thing to play a bunch and insert something that people can connect to and then bring them along, but it's another thing to play stuff that's completely way out, say, fuck the audience, you know. And it had happened. They refused to do it. They were arrogant and young, young rebels, and they eventually lost their audience, and then they eventually broke up because they didn't get along with each other. But that was one of the local groups that was really very good. Of course, Jack Webb was around, and Garby was around, but Garby was playing up at
Trino's.
Mm-hmm. And there were people like Mark Kirk who would play, and Guido, of course, came in on the scene, and he would play, and one of the discouraging things was a lot of times they'd be playing down at the table, and Garvey would have his band up at Trino's at the same time, and they would get frustrated with the fact that he was grabbing most of the audience because he was a big band, and, you know, that sort of
thing. That happened in the late 80s or mid-80s. When I was working Tuesday nights, because I think it was Tuesday night was big band night, and Doc Scott would play, and there'd be nobody at Doc's gig, and there'd be 1,000 people two blocks up over at Trino's.
You would get that, because Trino's was a general hangout, okay?
And plus, that was when it was with the big place, and they could host the big band.
Right, exactly. But, I mean, even at that time, they were hosting small little quartets. Mark Kirk had a quartet that used to play there pretty regularly.
At Trino's.
Yeah.
Okay.
And let's see, who else? Of course, Ray Sasaki, and then Ray and Morgan. So
Trino's was doing music, and that was just two blocks up, so that was on the Goodwin Avenue corridor.
Early on, the only music that they did, which was not regular or frequent, was Garb's Big Band.
Okay. Was the Red Herring doing anything at that point, really? Probably not. If they did,
On any regular basis were they doing any sort of music. Then they started doing a little bit of folk music. And I don't recall any jazz there. Okay. The Union did sometimes some jazz gigs with Ron and his brother.
Cecil Bridgewater?
Cecil and a couple other people that had gone on from here came back. And they, down the foyer, etc., it was sort of like an indoor-outdoor type place. Okay. They would do it, but those are special events. I mean, I think they did that, and I forget the name of the holiday, the Black Homecoming. Okay. Was that the... they would come in and they would do some of that. And then, of course, then there was Russell and Chuck and Sorghum, et cetera, which basically were a little, they were later. They were not in a real early table. As I said, there were, I'm trying to think of some of the other people that...
Well, tell me about what you did when you worked there. So you worked. So after a couple of years of hanging out, you started working?
Yeah, I was running short on money, and Terry said, he said, you want to work here, be night manager? He says, I can't pay a hell of a lot, but it'll be something. And I said, sure, why not? I'm here every night anyhow. And
was this after Saturday was born, or was this?
Before Saturday was born.
Before Saturday was born.
Actually, it was a year before Saturday was born that I started as a night manager. At the time, off and on, I was working remodeling and carpentry stuff with Lou or Larry or Mike Schiller during the day. And then at night I would come in and I'd work the table, and it gave Terry a break to go home and that sort of stuff.
So Terry was there basically all day and all night, except for breaks at that point.
In the earlier point, yeah.
Okay.
Later on, I think maybe a year or two before you came on, he stopped coming in every night. He backed off a little bit. He would come in basically before the band started to check that everything was set up, and then at closing to close. And then later on, I guess he didn't even start coming back to close. He let you guys close.
Yep.
The thing that was sort of unique was even throughout the whole period, I mean, it was like a small family. Everyone that worked there knew everyone. Even when I left, I knew everyone that came after me, type thing, you know. And I remember, well, it started out with with before the bread with chocolate chip cookies. Mm-hmm. And then I forget the name of the guy that came in and taught Terry how to make bread. And they had that oven, the pizza oven, mm-hmm. back in the back, behind the counter. Then they moved it over into the other room in the back, in front of the storehouse,
mm-hmm.
the storeroom. But Terry started making bread, and when he started making bread, then he started making gondolettes.
Oh, so bread wasn't there right off the bat?
No.
Huh.
I mean, that was something that someone that Terry knew brought in, okay? Hmm. And this guy, I'm not sure whether he was baking all the bread, okay? And then he said something about, well, the oven was not, the flue wasn't working quite right on the oven, etc. So that's when they moved it into the other room and put a new flue system in, so that the fire would be right, or the heat would be, the thermostat would work, whatever.
That was all the same room for me. I mean, behind the counter was the same room.
This wasn't behind the counter. This was in the room that ran beside the kitchen area.
Oh, got it.
Way in the back, in front of the storeroom.
Got it.
Okay. And they built a flue to go outside the side wall.
Okay. But then moved it into the back, into the main kitchen. Well, became the kitchen.
No, it moved out of the kitchen into that other room. And I don't know, maybe at some time they moved it back into the kitchen, but that was when the guy, he did that, they moved it, and then the guy left. And that's when Terry started baking his own bread. And you're right, it did wind up back in the kitchen.
I mean, that's where it always was when I
was. Okay. There was a point, though, in time where it was in that other room, in way in the back, where there used to be some tables.
Mm-hmm.
Moved the tables out, and they put it back against that wall with a flue.
That's crazy.
Type thing. but, no, the... and then I remember the one thing that I really loved was the gazpacho. And I wound up in the hospital with a collapsed lung. And I remember Shelley and Terry brought over some gazpacho in there. I mean,
was that the cure for the collapsed lung?
I don't know. Well, the whole irony of this whole sort of thing was I got in this room after they put the tubes in me, etc., and I woke up in this one room, and then they moved me to another room where there was another patient, and he was just about ready to be released in the next day or two, right? And he's on the phone ordering takeout Chinese food. And he says to me, he says, "You want any Chinese food?" And I think I said at that time, "No, I really would like some gazpacho." And I think Shelley was in the room at the time, told Terry. And Terry sent over a big cup, when he started from cups of gazpacho.
So you mentioned that you started hanging out a lot and that there was like a family there. So what was different about hanging out at the table versus other places in town?
There was, well, both Terry and Shelley had a very personal, open warmth towards people. You know, it wasn't, when you came in, unless you were a total stranger or a total ass, it wasn't like you were a customer coming in. It was like you're a friend coming in. You know, and it was just, it made you feel very comfortable. You didn't have to play games, you know. Matter of fact, well, I don't know whether a number of other people did it, but I know that I did it, and I know several of the musicians did it. If Terry was really busy and we wanted like a cup of coffee or something, we'd go behind the counter and make our own, right? The atmosphere, I guess, is it was not real formal. It was very open-ended, and you know, no one really felt that they had to put on high airs for anyone else. And I mean, even some of it, I think, had to do with Terry and Shelley, as well as the environment of the table. Some of it had to do, quite honestly, with the nature of the jazz musicians, local jazz musicians around here, which were very accepting of anyone. I mean, I used to get invited to their parties. I knew nothing. I wasn't a musician. I wasn't, you know, and I was accepted like I was one of them. You know, and they would do that with everyone. I mean, even to this day, you know, Morgan and those people don't put on any airs. You know, it's not like hoi polloi type of thing that some of the classical musicians pull. Mm-hmm. And so that made it a very inviting type of place. The you would get a couple of really strange sorts of incidents that would occur.
Of course.
That, you know, I mean, I remember, what the hell's her name now? The country and western violinist.
Allison Krauss.
Bluegrass, okay. Was performing at the table with Union Station, okay, with John Pinnell and those guys. And that was the time when I was working as a night manager. And her mother came in and set up cover in the front door, right? And she wouldn't let me in unless I paid cover. I said, "Hey, I work here. I'm the manager. I don't care. You got to pay cover, right?" I had to go in through the back door in order to get into work. Yeah, strange things like that.
So who were some of the people working there in the early days that you, if you remember?
I don't remember.
Okay, that's fine.
I know most of the, well, since I worked only at night, a lot of times I worked by myself.
So you were serving drinks too?
I was serving drinks, making sandwiches, everything else at night.
Okay.
The only thing I didn't do was I didn't collect cover. Usually even one of the patrons would sit there and collect covers. You know, Chuck Seagard would sit there and maybe collect cover, or someone else would do that.
Did you have to have a roll of cover when it was a roll of quarters when it was 50 cents cover?
I didn't have a roll of quarters, but I don't know. There may have been in the till. At that time, we had a cash register.
That's what I heard.
We had a cash register that printed out the receipts, you know, of the evening or of the time period, etc. And something happened that broke, and Terry got a new cash register that didn't do that. And then Mark Gold was working there later on, and he busted that cash register. And after that, I think, as you recall, they had just the cash drawer from that cash register. But Terry had a unique way of counting change. You know, he'd go $1, $5, etc. And he never counted the change. He'd just see how much the till was full and make a guesstimate on that. Mm-hmm. He'd count the paper money, but he wouldn't count the change. And
at least when I was working there, what we would do at night is we would count it, we would put it in a styrofoam cup, and then we'd put it inside the lettuce container inside the walk-in cooler, and Terry would come by in the morning to get it.
Well, you see, we didn't do that because Terry would come back at closing, I would close, and he'd come back and get the cash. After Guido came, there was another interesting little story. Guido, one time during a vacation period when the place was closed, was there cleaning the floors and the tables and everything else. And he'd be there, and I saw the door open one time, and I stopped in because I wanted to see who the hell, you know, was there, what was happening. And there's Guido mopping away with an old style in one hand and a mop in the other, and with music blaring, some tape, some cassette blaring, you know. But, you know, the table was one of those chameleon type places. It was very different at night from what it was during the day. And as I said, I often, for the most part, worked there by myself unless Terry came in, you know. But during the day, there was a staff. But I rarely ran into them because I was working days somewhere else.
Got it.
And so when you said, do I remember any of them? I don't, because they were day shift.
Makes sense.
But, you know, I mean, it was actually that lunch trade that enabled Terry to keep the evening thing going, because really the only thing that was selling at night was the beer,
mm-hmm.
and that was always served. And you know, that was gravy. If you didn't make anything in the lunch trade, or even sometimes in the early dinner trade, then in effect he didn't make anything that night, because the money that you made off beer was not all that great. Mm-hmm. I guess there wasn't that big a markup on draft beer at that point in time. But, you know,
well, it depends on the quantity sold.
Yeah, but I mean, the markup per glass, and given the wastage, because he didn't have the greatest cooling system for that, so a lot of times you get a lot of head, and you wind up throwing that away. But it was the lunch trade that helped him crack the nut to be able to afford the night stuff. The night stuff was basically him and Shelley for fun.
So tell me a couple Terry stories.
I remember at one point he had bought I think it was a Mercedes-Benz truck, and was running up to Chicago to shop for the table. And he'd get up some ungodly hour in the morning to get to this place, some street where there was a street market, and so he could buy supplies for the table, usually fresh food supplies. And he'd get back and, as usual, would bitch about, he was tired, exhausted, it was, You know,
was that the big gray van or was that a different one?
That was a different one. This was a big truck.
Big truck, okay.
This was one of those covered trucks, like.
Okay, because I knew when he had that big, like,
Econoline. No, he had an extended Econoline.
Yeah, right. Econoline. I remember, because he would go up to Chicago runs in that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was his personal vehicle. This, he basically, this was later towards the end of the gig, because after 2 years of doing that, he started making runs up there for other people, other restaurants, etc., and for a distributor. And they were actually paying him to go up to shop for them and to deliver, and he was using that big Mercedes-Benz truck to do that. And when that fell apart, he got rid of that truck. I remember the Econo van. He had that ever since I knew him from the very beginning, and that's what they went to Mexico in, was that Econo van.
No, they went in the RV. They bought that big RV to go to Mexico.
You're right. They still had the Econo van.
I think they left it behind, yeah.
I remember stories that of when they moved to where Sweet Betsy's was, which is now the Mexican restaurant. Mm-hmm. And at the time,
they were, when they came back from
when
Mexico,
they came back, they were table. Living there. Mm-hmm. Because the
they
renters
back,
the lease
they
early.
Came back early,
right?
They're supposed to be gone for a year.
And they came back.
They rented it out for a year, and they came back like
9 months,
something like that. Yeah.
And from what I understand, Terry was sleeping up in the attic. I don't know what the whole story was, but when I first went over there, before he remodeled it for Sweet Betsy's, it was like one big, it used to be a grocery store, and it was one big just open space.
Right.
And
I think it was a gas station at one point too, I think. Wasn't it?
Well, maybe, I don't know. It may have been a gas station with a convenience place in there, but I remember that was a grocery store.
Okay.
Type of thing. It was either that or it was the one that he later on was living in. That's now Gene McManus's.
Well, that was a convenience store.
Okay.
Most recently.
I mean, Terry had an unfortunate, unique way of renting to renters that never paid rent. I mean, he never had a winning renter. Yeah, and then there was, of course, White Street that he got involved in.
So tell me an early Shelley story, if you can remember. Maybe pre-kid days.
Well, I can tell you one kid day.
Okay.
One.
That's fine.
Where my mother came to town. It was the last time that she basically came to town. And I didn't realize it at the time, but she was basically dying of cancer, but I took her over to Terry and Shelley's house to meet Terry and Shelley and the kids. And next thing I know, my mother is playing ball with Tyson, who's a little 2-year-old, right? And they're playing catch. I looked at my mom and I said, "Mom, you never did that with me." She says, "But you were my kid." You know? And she met, you know, Shelley and Terry and Sarity. The twins weren't born yet. And that was one story. The time with the kids. The one with the kids that was the funniest one of all was, I used to give them Christmas presents, right? And one Christmas, I came up with the bright idea. I would give them $25 each, and I'd take them to Toys R Us, and I'd turn them loose to buy whatever they wanted for $25. What a fiasco. You ever try and control 4 kids? The twins were there, and they were 2-year-olds. Tyson was a little older. two-year-olds went in different directions. Next thing I know, I hear speakers in the store saying, well, the owner of the such and such little girl, please come and get her. She's knocking down all the displays. There was a thing of balls. They knocked all the balls. They were rolling all over the house. The other twin went in the other direction. Later on, I get a call about her. Tyson didn't want to spend the money. He picked up a little 5-cent toy. And I said, Tyson, you got $25 to spend. Get something else. You know, no, this is good enough. This is good enough. And I had to fight with him to get to spend the money. And then Saturday got a 4-foot doll that was as big as she was. But after that, I learned my lesson. I never took him to a toy store again. After that, I would get him a $100 gift certificate to the video store on 6th Street, I think. Yeah,
That's Rentertainment?
Rentertainment, yeah. And let them get video stuff. And I did that for years. And this is one that involved basically the whole family. The twins were infants at the time. Terry and Shelley were in their room washing the twins in the bassinet. They were just walking at that point. They take the twins out, they dry them off, they give them their pajamas and send them out to me to put their pajamas on. Well, I remember when I was a kid, you had pajamas and they had the feet and the flap down back, but the feet were covered, but the hands weren't. These newfangled pajamas had the hand covers, etc. I didn't know which end was up. I put the pajamas on so I had their head going through the backside flap. And Terry and Shelley are watching. They didn't say a word, but they started laughing their ass off, right? After that, neither of the twins would ever come to me to put their pajamas on.
Sounds like a smart move on their part.
Yeah, it was. But I remember I looked up and I was really getting frustrated because I couldn't figure it out. This has flaps on both hands and both feet. Which side's up? Yeah. And I look up for help and there they are, almost rolling on the floor laughing, you know.
So you took lots of pictures over the years.
Yeah.
And then some of the musicians came to you, to your studio, to then get pictures taken.
No, it didn't unfortunately work out that way.
Oh, it didn't work that way, okay.
I took a lot of candids. Some musicians did ask me to do publicity portraits, etc. of them. And it's always wound up being non-paying jobs. And when they got really good gigs up in Chicago, then they used the Chicago photographer that they paid big money for. You know. So
you had at least one art showing at the table.
No, not at the table. I had the Levis Center.
Are you sure there wasn't one at the table? I thought I saw a poster for one.
You may have seen a poster, but I didn't have a showing at the table. I may have put up some photographs at the table,
okay,
but I didn't have a show there.
Okay.
Or something I would consider a show. I mean, there were some empty walls, and I may have put up some pictures on the empty walls. Because
we used to do that. We did art openings frequently where we rotated the art.
Yeah, well, I didn't have any sort of opening over there. Okay. I went to Levis Center, and I did a show called Hands and Instruments.
And it was all table photos then?
It was all table photos. It was, some of them were of musicians. I had some with Guido. And some were of just hands and instruments and focused in on just the hands and the instruments. Many of them were manipulated in one fashion or another. I had it at Levis Center. And I made up a real fancy picture. Basically, it was I masked out Chuck Tripp, but it was his guitar and his hands on the guitar. And okay. the visual sounds of music or something like that. I forget what I titled to the show. But Terry and Shelley wanted to cater the opening from the table, or bring stuff from the table, but Levis Center wouldn't let them. That show was going the time that Steve McCall was in town, played at the table, and that crew. And the
Chicago musicians.
Right. The day before they're performing that night, and they had performed the night before too. And that day they went over to look at the show. And I mean, I just had told them that I had a show up, but I didn't tell them to go there. And they came back, and evidently they liked the photographs. And it was funny, after their gig that night, I closed up the table, and they took me along to the restaurant on the corner of Neil and
Marianne's
Diner. And we were there the whole night, rest of the night. They ordered all kinds of breakfast and everything else, just shooting the bull. And the unfortunate thing is, I think a year later, the bass player, Oscar Brown Jr. III, was killed in an auto accident. Steve McCall died, I think, 2 years later. And I'm not sure who the other players were.
I found a poster for that gig. I can't remember who else was in it.
And, but I mean, the thing was that when I say that was the sort of place, and unfortunately, the musicians were all friendly. You know, they weren't haughty and that sort of stuff. Where that sort of interaction would occur, interaction with, you know, members of the audience. It's sort of like when you go to the Iron Post and you interact with Larry Gray or Jeff Helgeson while they're on the bandstand, or Randy. You know, there was that informal friendship and relationship going on. It wasn't like a formal concert type atmosphere. Terry had some... what do I want to say? Some unique things that we used to have fun with and also bitch about. When White Street, when we went to Lois's yoga class that Shelley forced us into taking, and she was a real torturer. I mean, both of us would come away really complaining like hell. I never went back. Terry went back. But you know, I mean, the thing is that he'd set things up for, like, ropes on the walls and stuff. And I looked at him and I said, hey, you should have no problem with this. You're the athlete. I said, how come you're complaining as much as I am? But, you know, things like that Shelley would get us into. Yeah, it wasn't things that we really wanted to do. I mean, sometimes there would be productions, like a couple that Terry were in that were videoed type things, that Shelley would instigate and Terry would go along with.
I think we're going to wrap it up. How about some final thoughts on what the table meant to you, to other people?
Well, I think the table stood basically for everyone as a form of community center to start with, and a community center in which there were mostly jazz, but all kinds of arts going on at one point or another, a hangout, you know, and it was a place where friends met. It was like that bar on television. I mean, you didn't have the full array of alcohol, but it was one of those things where at night, as I said, it was a very different place than during the day, where you have people eat and leave, etc. You have people hung there, and everyone seemed to know everyone. And if they didn't, they soon became friendly anyway. And this is particularly true when a lot of the professional musicians would come across the street from Cranard after performing at Cranard. They would come and sit, and they'd socialize with everyone that was there. You know, so it was a place that did that, that was close enough to the music school that it could service the students and give the students an outlet not only to play and create, but an introduction to meeting other musicians, professional musicians, as well as to playing. You know, I mean, it's like I told Tim McNamara that he ought to really go and hang with Guido and learn some of the stuff that Guido knows, because Guido isn't going to be around forever. And, you know, he knows a lot of crap that might be useful and that you might like to learn. And afterward, Tim did that. You know, it was that sort of a hang for students. It was a place where they could hone their chops, also learn a little bit about the game, and meet other musicians that would serve them later on as contacts, if not people to play with. You know, I mean, the irony is that a lot of really high quality musicians have passed through this town, and many of them passed through the table. Mm-hmm. And so it gave each generation someone who was a little bit more advanced from them, who was high quality, to role model and to play with and learn from. You know, I mean, I think I told you the story about Sal Moderano playing on a Lawrence Hobgood gig in the table. And they were playing, they're both sitting on the same piano stool, playing, one playing at one end of the piano, one playing at the other. And evidently, Sal decided he wanted to play solo, so he gave this hip swing type thing and knocked Lawrence clear off the piano stool and took over the piano. But I mean, I don't know where else in town someone like Lawrence at that stage in the game of his career could meet someone like Sal and play with someone like Sal at all. I mean, that just didn't happen at any of the other venues. You know, so, I mean, it was like an extension of the university in that regard. Mm-hmm. You know, the unfortunate thing was that, you know, Terry was also pretty much dependent on who the university brought in as to who he could get to stop over the table, because he didn't have a bunch of bucks to bring someone in. You know, and, you know, the some of the people who had contacts didn't initially go out to bring someone in. It was only if they were coming in town anyway. But Terry was very fortunate in that regard, that, you know, they would come over the table, and that gave the table some of its reputation as well. But it was, in that regard, it was really very unique. And I think, you know, that's why people remember it, that's why people constantly refer back to it. It was sort of like, if you listen to the rockers from the 60s, they're constantly talking about Panama Reds and Ruby Gulch and who they saw there. Mm-hmm. Because during that period, those were the two big venues. Mm-hmm. And they were a different sort of hangout. They were, sort of a concert hangout. I mean, you didn't socialize with the people because there was a stage and it was separated and that sort of stuff. The table was just like that, just it didn't have the stage.
Got it. All right, that sounds like a good ending point. Thank you, Laurie.